Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. More at alyeskapipeline.com.
The answer is to fix it, bring somebody else in then, and continue to provide that service, which is a lifeline to pilots that are operating right here.
State and federal officials advocate for improvements to Alaska's aviation infrastructure. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 31st. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, a plan to increase safety on a stretch of the Seward Highway is getting mixed reactions from some Anchorage policymakers.
I'm still unconvinced that a highway widening project is going to create more safety.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Consider a gift of stock to Alaska Public Media. You may avoid paying capital gains tax and receive a deduction. Learn more at alaskapublic.org/stock or contact your financial advisor.
Alaska aviation experts and air carriers pushed for improving and maintaining existing weather stations instead of only focusing on building new infrastructure at an aviation safety summit hosted by state and federal officials in Anchorage today. Several dozen representatives from air carriers and associations from across Alaska participated in the summit. Senator Dan Sullivan led the roundtable. He pointed to the state's high rate of plane crashes and related fatalities and said weather stations that report current conditions are crucial. He says while there are plans to build more than 150 new weather stations in the state, local air carriers are frustrated they often can't use existing ones.
We are getting infrastructure, weather systems in particular, throughout the state. That's great. But one of the outcomes of this summit is we currently have weather systems and aviation, lighting and things in rural communities that it takes months. And to be honest, in certain cases, even years to fix. That's unacceptable.
Just earlier this week, a widespread outage affected dozens of weather stations across the state. Industry experts say that on any given day, up to 20 existing stations in Alaska are not reporting. Sullivan said one idea that came out of the discussion was to contract local transportation staff to fix those stations instead of waiting for Federal Aviation Administration staff from out of state. Another idea was to create a spare part depot in Alaska to speed up fixing stations. And Sullivan said stakeholders spoke about creating a better way to communicate issues and outages to the FAA. In addition to automated weather data, pilots also use flight service stations to get information about weather and runway conditions and for emergency assistance. Right now, at least 4 flight service stations across Alaska are closed, and more are operating at limited capacity as a result of the FAA placing employees at those stations on administrative leave. Jennifer Homendy is the National Transportation Safety Board chairwoman. She says flight station closures are a safety concern for pilots who rely on them, especially when weather infrastructure is not reporting.
We do need those back up and running. Totally understand that there were issues with personnel. That's besides the point. The answer is not to close it. The answer is to fix it, bring somebody else in then, and continue to provide that service, which is a lifeline to pilots that are operating right here in Alaska.
An FAA official said at the meeting that the affected stations will remain closed for the immediate future and that the agency is looking at several options to provide redundancy in services, but nothing has been decided. Meanwhile, a state plan to increase safety on a stretch of the Seward Highway between Anchorage and Girdwood is raising the hackles of some Anchorage policymakers who say it's the wrong fix in the wrong place. They say the project is too expensive and likely won't make the highway much safer, but as Alaska Public Media's Hannah Floor reports, the state says the project will improve a dangerous stretch of road.
Anchorage Assemblymember Daniel Voland is not a fan of the Safer Seward Highway project.
I'm still unconvinced that a highway widening project is going to create more safety.
Voland is on the committee that votes on Anchorage area traffic projects. He told committee members there are so many roads within the downtown district he represents that are so much more deadly than that stretch of the Seward Highway.
I don't understand the prioritization, what seems to be the strong prioritization on this project.
Critics like Voland say, at best, the state will be embarking on a long, expensive project, nearly $1.5 billion over the next 20 years, which won't significantly improve safety. At worst, they say, the changes could make the road less safe. The Alaska Department of Transportation is planning the Safer Seward Highway project for roughly 20 miles of the road between Anchorage and Girdwood. Right now, most of that stretch is a two-lane highway, with Chugach State Park on one side and Turnagain Arm on the other. The plan is to widen the road to four lanes and straighten it out in places. But critics point out that there's a lot of data that shows when roads are wider and straighter, people drive faster. And that's a problem.
You cannot design for speed and safety at the same time.
That's Heidi Simon with Smart Growth America in Washington, D.C. She's worked with traffic engineers on transportation safety for more than a decade. She says it's a simple formula. Higher speeds increase the likelihood that an accident will be deadly.
We know that speed is one of the biggest contributing factors to whether someone's going to walk away from a crash with their life.
The plan is for the speed limit to stay the same, at 55 miles per hour. But Simon says that doesn't matter. People drive the speed that feels right, not the posted speed limit. The design also includes wider shoulders and a median dividing the road, which should help, according to Simon. DOT's Lauren Little is leading the Safer Seward project. She says the four-lane divided design will make the highway safer.
It just provides that margin for people to all get what they need out of this highway without running into each other.
She says right now, drivers don't have the space to recover if they start to leave the road.
If you make a mistake out there, you're running into the ocean, you're running into a rock, or you're running into another car.
She says the median would also prevent head-on collisions. In the 5 years of data collected by DOT, three of the four fatal accidents were head-on. And Little says she doesn't believe widening the road will encourage people to drive faster.
We're already seeing people speeding. The people that want to go 80 are going to go 80.
Little says DOT used predictive modeling to show the proposed plan would decrease crashes by roughly two-thirds. But Assemblymember Aaron Baldwin Day says the numbers used to plan the project are cherry-picked. She's also on the committee that votes on Anchorage area traffic projects.
The data and the assumptions around this project are fundamentally flawed, and therefore anything that comes out of that is going to be problematic for the community.
Baldwin Day says DOT didn't use consistent criteria when eliminating possible alternative plans. She says that stretch of the Seward Highway does need safety improvements, but not this plan. She says she doesn't understand why DOT engineers would choose a design that goes against basic traffic safety principles.
There are so many things that just don't make sense. And so if you're perplexed, if you're confused, if you're wondering, like, what on earth is going on here? Really valid response.
Baldwin Day says she also doesn't understand why DOT is prioritizing this project in the first place. She points to DOT's own ranking of the state's most dangerous roads. That portion of the Seward Highway doesn't even crack the top 50, she says. She says she's repeatedly asked DOT officials the same questions, and she says she hasn't gotten good explanations. DOT's Lauren Little says she knows people are confused.
We need to do a better job of helping people understand how we got here and understanding, you know, if there are components that we missed.
DOT is working with the mayor's office to schedule a public listening session in September. In Anchorage, I'm Hannah Floor.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, despite some logistical challenges, stock car enthusiasts find a home on a racetrack in Kodiak.
You show up and it was, oh, did you get it fixed? Did you get a test drive? No, I didn't get a test drive. I fixed it late last night.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska Public Media is now partnering with an Alaskan auction service so a helpful local team can get the biggest return for the least hassle should you decide to donate your vehicle. Learn more at alaskapublic.org/vehicle.
A raven knocked out power for hundreds of customers in the resort town of Girdwood, according to Chugach Electric. Chugach received a report at about 8 a.m. today that power was out for the entire community. Utility spokesperson Julie Haskett says a raven made contact with wiring inside a current transformer, triggering the outage.
And that caused a cascading series of events where it damaged the transformer, the control wiring from the transformer, and damage was done all the way into the Girdwood substation circuit switcher, which supplies Girdwood.
Haskett says the raven died as a result. A crew arrived at Girdwood at about 9:45 a.m. to begin working on a fix.
It's not just a simple remove the raven, fix it right there. There's several points of contact or damage, if you will, that need to be repaired, including into the circuit switcher that supplies the Girdwood substation.
Haskett estimated that power would be restored by early evening, and she said it's not uncommon for animals like squirrels or birds to trigger smaller outages, though this one was more severe.
What is unusual is just the extensive amount of damage that was caused by the initial contact. Some wires were burned, if you will, and then other parts of the system were damaged as well.
Chugach Electric serves just under 2,000 customers in the Girdwood area, according to an outage map. Meanwhile, a new class developed by whale biologists and marine pilots in Southeast Alaska will soon teach mariners how to avoid hitting humpback whales when sailing large ships through the region. The training comes as the state's cruise industry booms. KTOO's Alex Solomon reports.
Humpback whales migrate thousands of miles from their winter breeding grounds in Hawaii and Mexico to feed in Alaska's rich waters over the summer. And that's when ship traffic surges, with hundreds of cruises and whale watching tours. This summer, some ports in Southeast expect to see a record number of cruise ship passengers. Chris Gabriel is a whale biologist at Glacier Bay National Park. She and her colleagues published a scientific paper in 2019 demonstrating that large ships can maneuver around whales. Their results inspired them to make a class that shows mariners how.
It teaches them about whale behavior and how to maybe help predict where the whales are going to move, and then suggest strategies to avoid collisions.
In Alaska, it's illegal for vessels to get within 100 yards of humpback whales, speed near them, block their path, or disrupt their behavior. But it's still common for ships to hit whales, causing severe and sometimes fatal injuries. Gabriel says the day-long class will kick off at the University of Alaska Southeast in Ketchikan this August. The plan is to make the training modules available anywhere that can run them.
Any maritime training facility could offer it anywhere at no cost.
That means cruise employees from abroad who plan to sail in Southeast could soon take the class in their home countries. Gabriel says the curriculum incorporates computer simulations that use data collected by marine mammal observers aboard large cruise ships that sailed through Glacier Bay National Park.
So in the simulations, we try to authentically portray whale behavior in terms of the movement and dive patterns.
The curriculum is also infused with the knowledge of local marine pilots who help large ships navigate through local waters.
Pilots have responsibility to the state of Alaska with our licensing that we take care of life, property, and the environment. Whales are lives, and whales are also part of the environment. So there you go. It's a responsibility that I believe we all have.
That's Rich Preston with the Southeast Alaska Pilots Association, calling in from the Discovery Princess docked in Hoonah. He's been a marine pilot in Southeast for 16 years and helped Glacier Bay scientists develop the class. Preston says students will practice maneuvering around whales with computer simulations that get progressively more difficult throughout the day. Four students can take the class at a time, role-playing a typical bridge team of a large ship. Pilot, officer of the watch, helmsman, and lookout.
The lookout says, I see a whale. Everybody looks in that direction where the lookout spotted the whale. And then a command is given to try and maneuver the ship. And then it takes time for a vessel to turn. It just doesn't turn on a dime. It's not like a car.
Preston says that time lag means the bridge team must work together to make good decisions quickly.
I would say that most of the time it is possible to do something. It all comes down to, quite honestly, how far away is the whale when we spot it and how fast is the vessel going?
He says cruise ships can reach a top speed of about 22 knots, but they're typically going slower, around 15 knots. Preston says pilots slow down to about 10 knots in areas with whales. Bridge teams typically know where those areas are by using Whale Alert, an app that maps crowdsourced whale sightings. Right now, the class is specific to humpback whales in Southeast, but Gabriel says it could be adapted to other species and places in the future. In Juneau, I'm Alex Solomon.
Landslides are a part of life in Southeast Alaska, but often not included in traditional insurance policies. This week, an organization looking to reduce landslide risk and impacts in the region heard from insurance experts on a new option they say is worth exploring. KCAW's Catherine Rose reports.
Alien abduction insurance, a golfer's hole-in-one coverage, and zombie apocalypse protection. Which one is a real insurance policy? Insurance specialist Jacqueline De Medici Bruno says all of them.
The reason I like sharing this isn't just for a laugh. It actually makes a serious point. Insurance is remarkably flexible. If there's a way to measure a risk and price it, there's usually a way to build a policy around it. no matter how unusual it sounds.
Landslides, however, are not so unusual in Southeast Alaska. In just over a decade, the region has seen 4 fatal landslides. Still, insuring against them is a challenge. It's a problem that the folks with SLIP are all too familiar with. That's the Southeast Alaska Landslide Information Preparedness Partnership. It's a group dedicated to reducing the risk of landslides in the region. At its July meeting, the coalition heard from Bruno, a longtime insurance regulator who now works for the sustainability nonprofit Ceres, about insurance options for the region. A traditional homeowner's insurance policy usually protects a home's structure from windstorms and hail to vandalism and water damage, but there are often exclusions in the policies.
Some of these exclusions make intuitive sense, you know, wear and tear, pest infestation, those are maintenance issues, not, you know, sudden accidents. So insurance was never designed to cover those type of things. But flood, earthquake, and landslide are different. These are catastrophic risks that tend to hit an entire region at once. And insurers manage that kind of correlated risk very differently from, say, an isolated house fire.
When it came to the slides in Sitka, Haines, Wrangell, and Ketchikan, Bruno said homeowners' insurance exclusions forced many affected families to rely on the federal government after they were displaced.
Every one of those families may have had a standard homeowner's policy, but all of those policies excluded landslide damage. Recovery instead depended on a federal disaster declaration. Even the main federal program that funds landslide hazard monitoring has lapsed with reauthorization still pending, so that safety net isn't guaranteed to be there either.
Bruno said the exclusions are not an unsolvable problem, though. Parametric insurance may be one of the answers. Unlike traditional insurance, where you file a claim for damages after the fact, with parametric insurance, the payout is agreed upon ahead of time.
Everyone agrees up front on a measurable trigger, something like a certain amount of rainfall in a certain amount of time. Once that trigger is crossed or met, payment goes out automatically, often within days or even hours.
Parametric insurance doesn't exist for slides in Southeast yet, but Bruno thinks it could. It works in 3 steps. First, a parameter is set, like a certain magnitude of earthquake or a level of rainfall or a temperature. And that parameter is monitored continuously. Once it crosses the agreed-upon threshold, the payment is triggered. In Cancun, the government used parametric insurance to protect its tourism economy and reef from high winds. And Bruno said in the first pilot season of a program in India, 21,000 women's wages were quickly covered by parametric insurance when high heat exceeded a pre-agreed-upon temperature threshold, making it unsafe for the women to work.
And that's kind of the brilliance of it, is that there is so much flexibility within the structure of parametric itself that, you know, it can be built to look like what you want it to look like or cover what you want it to cover.
She said it does not replace traditional coverage or close all the gaps, but it can offer some protection where other insurance can't and with less red tape. Bruno spoke for about 30 minutes before she took a few questions from the audience. Mike Janes, an avalanche forecaster, asked if the weather stations used to confirm triggers in any of the pilot programs had to meet certain standards.
Not all weather stations are created equal in measuring precipitation, either because of their location or... And so I was just curious if you could speak to what does it take to get these weather stations to be able to make a trigger like this that's reliable and useful.
Bruno said there aren't any mandated requirements at this time, and the insurance carrier and the customers can work together to determine the best way to measure that data. It's flexible because the parametric insurance market is an emerging space.
I know in one case, I forget which state, but it was a parametric flood product for homeowners, and they actually went and installed sensors in each of the homeowners' yards. So there are different ways, you know, to get at that. There's no set standardization quite yet.
Bruno said she was not aware of any emerging pilot programs for parametric insurance in Alaska yet, but encouraged SLIP to push and ask. In places where pilots have been successful, groups have worked with local governments, philanthropic organizations, and NGOs to make the parameters possible. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Catherine Rose.
The Eklutna tribe's powwow and potlatch happens only once every 2 years, but when it does, it draws hundreds and hundreds of people to the village of Eklutna, a few miles north of Anchorage. A weekend of dancing, drumming, and feasting kicks off at 11 a.m. tomorrow at the tribe's powwow grounds off the Glen Highway at mile 26. The celebration is free and open to the public. Aaron Leggett, the president of the native village of Eklutna, says what makes him most proud is that no one leaves hungry because the tribe feeds everyone.
We'll have moose, various types of moose stew and roast and fish, salmon. It's just sort of our way of really being open and good community partners.
Many also bring dishes to share. Leggett says the tribe has plenty to celebrate this year, including the groundbreaking for its long-awaited gathering hall, funded in part by the success of its new casino. But more than anything, Leggett says, the gathering is a chance for Anchorage, Chugiak, and Eagle River to get to know their neighbors in the village of Eklutna.
There are certainly people that wouldn't necessarily, you know, when they think of Eklutna, maybe they would think of the cemetery and the church, but don't really have any other sense of it. The powwow potlatch really was our way of increasing awareness to the community and building that up.
The theme for this year's event is Restoring Our River, 97 Years Later. It spotlights the tribe's efforts to restore the natural flow of the Eklutna River and its wild salmon runs. Meanwhile, Kodiak has less than 100 miles of roads, less than half of that paved, but the island is home to one of the most remote stock car racetracks in the country. The scene in Kodiak is more grassroots than elsewhere, but as KMXT's Catherine Irving reports, racers say that makes the community all the stronger.
Kodiak's quarter-mile dirt racetrack doesn't have many bells and whistles. The press box where the announcer sits is made out of an old boat wheelhouse, and the three sets of stands are wood with the paint peeling off. But on a sunny Saturday, the bleachers are packed with fans snacking on hot dogs and hamburgers, ready for a day at the races. Race days include competitions for motocross, ATVs, and more. But the biggest and loudest event is the stock cars. Sarah Rohrer has been racing stock cars here for 10 years.
We've had a few late nights, midnight, working on the cars. The finale is right now. Now, like, all the work's been done, we're going to go have fun.
Kodiak has what's called hobby stock car racing, known as a good entry point because of its relatively low cost. Hobbyists strip cheap vintage cars of everything except the essentials. They refit them with necessary speed and safety features and redecorate the outside. Josh Good is another racer. He stands in front of his gray and red car.
You know, it's like the 40-foot rule. It looks really good from 40 feet. The closer you get, the more you see.
Of Alaska's five racetracks, Kodiak's is the smallest and most remote, being the only one off the road system. It's located in the island's fairgrounds, where horses graze in pastures and bears catch salmon across the road. Many tracks, like the Alaska Raceway Park in Palmer, are affiliated with organizations like NASCAR and the International Motor Contest Association. But smaller racetracks like Kodiak's make their own rules. At this level, there's not much prize money, so for people like Good, it's a passion project.
I was a teacher for a long time, and I taught kindergarten, and I'd always ask the kids on the first day of school what they wanted to be when they grew up. And the other teacher, my like mentor teacher, was like, you need to have an answer for that. So my answer was always, I want to be a race car driver. And then now here I am, like I'm driving stock cars every other weekend.
Today, there are seven cars racing, each of them supported by volunteer pit crews made up of friends and family. Rohrer says it's the most they've had since she can remember, but it wasn't always that way. Wayne Hartford used to race stock cars in Kodiak back in the early 2000s, before moving to Anchor Point. He says interest in the sport nearly died out in the early 2010s before a volunteer named Craig DeHart decided to help fix it.
It was probably in the 2013 or 14, it was really slow down there, and he got together with some of the other companies in that town and did a lot of work on the track, and that's when it built back up again.
Getting vehicles and equipment to the island is a challenge. Parts might take weeks to arrive, and Good says repairs often get done last minute.
You show up and it was, oh, did you get it fixed? Did you get a test drive? No, I didn't get a test drive. I fixed it late last night, or I was filling the oil this morning, or whatever.
Because of the challenges, keeping the sport alive on Kodiak takes a village. One hobbyist purchased and ferried in several cars from mainland Alaska to sell on to prospective drivers. Other racers sell cars before they move, so future racers don't have to bring in other ones. Good says that because the community is so small, even the most competitive of drivers are always there to lend a hand. Good's only been driving for a few years, so he says he needed the advice.
everybody was just really welcoming. Like, we had questions, and they're like, oh, yeah, this is what the last guy did, or this is what you could look at, and, or maybe we have a spare part.
Here we go.
The first heat of three has finished. During the break, drivers and their pit crews take stock of any damage and make repairs. One driver's car didn't finish the race, and pit crew and other racers come to help him fix it.
What the heck, man?
In the end, though, he has to bow out after the second heat. Rohrer says that's par for the course.
Like, you can put the time, and of course it's a lot of money and all of that, and sometimes it just doesn't pan out, which is devastating, but then when it does work, it's all worth it.
Things are real nasty out there on the inside corner.
The final heat, with only four racers left, ends in chaos. A car loses a tire, another spins out.
Oh,
Rohrer has to get towed off the track, and Good wins by default.
Josh might just get to sneak in there and grab the checkered flag, even though no one knows what's going on. But
the drivers don't seem to mind. For many, like Good, just getting out there on the track is just as fun as you'd think it would be. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Catherine Irving.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Aliona Nidzin, Hannah Floor, and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, Alex Solomon in Juneau, Catherine Rose in Sitka, and Catherine Irving in Kodiak. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer tonight is Crystal Hyde. Kirsten Dobroth is our producer. And I'm Wesley Early. Have a great weekend.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.